to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Before I turn over to John and Oliver, who will give you a more operational sense what the Law Lab is actually doing right now, I wanted to tell you some pieces about the history, how, you know, why we created the Law Lab initiative, why we launched this initiative. It all goes back to a workshop that was hosted in early 2008 by the Grutter Institute in collaboration with the Kauffman Foundation. And the workshop's topic was very straightforward, but, you know, kind of a deep topic. The question was, how can law foster innovation and entrepreneurship? That was the workshop topic. And there were about 20 invited experts from all disciplines, various backgrounds, to discuss this question. And in a way, it was like, as it turned out later on, it was also like a little contest of ideas. How do we best approach this topic and think about it and kind of develop almost a research agenda based on this initial conversation? Now, I think one of the common threads, one of the outcomes of this initial workshop in 2008 was, well, we have probably to be innovative about the law itself when we think about the relationship between law and innovation. And of course, innovation not only in terms of technological innovation, but innovation in society at large, so also institutional innovation and so forth. So what does that mean to be innovative about the law itself? Now, first and foremost, it certainly means you should not only include lawyers in the discussion, because lawyers are usually, we have exceptions here, of course, but usually are not the most innovative people. So the big push came from colleagues from evolutionary biology or neuroscience saying, well, you really have to think more innovative terms about the law itself. Now, this was very intriguing as a challenge, actually. What does it mean to think in innovative ways about the law itself? And the way we actually started to continue the discussion and frame the debate is, well, let's think how law works in a digitally networked environment. What does actually law mean in a digitally networked environment in the internet age? And there were like two obvious entry points that shaped then the future discussions. First one, well, one of the things we've learned in cyber law is not only about the law in the conventional sense of, you know, the East Coast law or the law enacted by legislators, but law is about governance, is about interplay and organizing the interplay of different constraints on behavior. Code is law as well, as we learned from Lawrence Lessig. But also social norms are really important regulators and constraints on behavior. Look at Wikipedia, a very interesting case study to show the power of social norms when it comes to governance of behavior. Many more examples, of course, to add. So that's kind of one of the lessons learned. Law in cyberspace is not only about the law, but it's about different modes of regulation that we have to take into account. And I think the second kind of insight that we had bringing together the various threads of discussion is, well, cyber law also teaches us something about the methods, how we do research, how we can do research in this new environment, that we can actually build applications, that we can run experiments in the wild, using platforms, do stuff on Facebook, whatever you name the platform or the application, and to experiment with some of the new governance models that we may come up with in the first place. Now, taking these pieces together, the only question was, well, where would be a good place or what would be a good format to experiment both with the design of law in this very broad sense And using some of the methods that, you know, we have all developed collectively to research on this topic, relationship between law and innovation. And that was basically the birth hour, I would say, of the Law Lab, because as it turns out, you know, in science you have labs, we're used to that as places of innovation, reinventing some of their own concepts within science. You even have a media lab for technology, for social scientists and so forth. But we wanted to fill this gap. Well, we need a place where lawmakers, policymakers, both from the private sector as well as from the public sector, can come together, have conversations, more in a network style lab, of course, about these issues, about innovation within law itself. And that's very roughly like the beginning of the Law Lab and the core idea behind it, to establish a platform where we can do research, but also where we can do experiments, where we can build tools, where we can do observational studies. So it's a very rich environment, open for collaboration. It's very much a network approach that we've taken. Of course, then the next challenge was to make that more concrete and come up with specific research tracks to further investigate some of the core ideas that were discussed at this initial workshop. And John and Oliver, who I introduced already, will now give you a more granular sense of what the three tracks are that we are currently working on, very much in the light of, you know, law and innovation. So with
without
further ado, please.
Well, thank you. We've been doing this for about a year, and there's still, I think there's a lot of, we haven't done a very good job of sort of communicating what we're trying to do, because it's sort of a very broad mandate. And I was looking over the tag list up there of different projects, and I think we've got 6 or 7 tags. So I think maybe the measure of success here is to expand the sort of understanding of what we're trying to achieve. And so this is sort of I got carried away with the what you can do with Keynote. But it's sort of a, and people say it's a lab. Well, what kind of lab? Is it a meth lab? What school are we? But we're really doing something more than that. I would say so. In a nutshell, it was sort of. It's multidisciplinary, and I think there's a particular bias that we confess to is sort of what I call the evo neurocompu hyphenated approach to neuroeconomics, evolutionary biology, really taking the hard sciences are coming in a really interesting way, in a very multidisciplinary way, to rethink about a lot of things, that how people interact, how norms are formed, how values are formed. So there's a very rich fundamental science that we're trying to draw upon in a very interdisciplinary way. And then the other one is Orr's mentioned, so the experiments in the wild. The fact that you have all these people out there, all the data, and if you can develop the tools, you can run experiments at a fraction of a cost of traditional experiments and with much bigger samples. And so there's just it changes what is possible in the social sciences, and this is something that Yokai's been focused on, and it is a key component of what we're trying to do. And then the other one is, I think, as Orr's also alluded to, there is sort of a mission aspect to it. Really interested in developing open technology. How do you create new kinds of software governance mechanisms that people can then experiment with and invent and apply and used in the everyday world? And it's sort of the private production of, as I said earlier, it's just not just laws, norms, it's rules. It's rethinking in a very, very fundamental way and creating a new kind of vocabulary. Think about what is the law. And so I have my own view of why the Law Lab. I think that what's so fascinating is so many things are becoming digital now. And that there was an article in the Economist on mobile phones and the fact that studies, I think, was done at the business school, saying they can make a correlation of the use of mobile phones in economic development and education. So it has a real impact. More and more things are being done on the net, being embedded in the virtual world. And you're going to have sort of a global community that's going to be digital, connected digitally. At the same time, you get the rate of innovation that's happening digital on a sort of biological from cultural digital basis is so rapid that is completely changing sort of our concept of time and innovation. And then really the inability of traditional legal processes to keep pace with this kind of change. We were at a Summit 2.0 conference on Governance 2.0 in Washington, and sort of one of the bylines there was code, rather than have consensus, it's code. The people getting impatient with the legislative process. Why don't we build something? Why don't we do it, see how it works? And then there's been underinvestments in IT technology, really, in the whole legal system. I mean, you compare that to what's happening in finance and transport, and that has not happened in sort of the whole judicial legislative sector. So there's a huge change that's starting to take place. And the globalization, privatization, jurisdictions, and rulemaking, that's another major area. Suddenly, people are really having to figure out how to do things on their own, and you find that's happening more and more than that. And then on the surveillance and security issue, I mean, the fact that the technology is such, and this is one of my interests, is how do you protect privacy and security without actually inhibiting natural free flow of ideas and people? And so the way I sort of have put it is I think there's sort of the soft tech, where I said norms, laws, institutions need to innovate at the same rate as hard tech. There's this sort of discontinuity that's not keeping up with it. And so one of the approaches that we're taking is developing what we call like an open governance platform. And the idea is building on sort of concept of cloud computing, where you have an open interoperable platform and you have different kinds of mechanisms, and I'll get into these a little bit later, that people are able to draw upon services and mash them up and develop their own sort of self-governance networks and sort of invent and create and explore new kinds of rulemaking and new kinds of regimes of self-governance. So the first one of these that is really essential is identity systems and how do you have persistent contextual mobile identities, the whole issue of anonymity, pseudo-anonymity. This is something that I've been working with over the last 5 years at Berkman through a Project Higgins. Doxman was part of that whole earlier effort in VRM. But you can't really have trusted networks unless you have some way of authenticating identity. And then that raises a whole set of issues about then, okay, to what extent can that be used and abused? But it's very sort of fundamental to building any kind of member network or governance mechanism. The other one is reputation systems. The idea that you can have a reliable reputation system that you can count on, it's verifiable, then allows you to really trust in people and the assertions they make about themselves and identify expertise. Dispute resolution, this is something that ORS has been particularly interested in. So how can you simplify and build new kind of mechanisms for dispute resolution online? Another, again, is credit assignment. Very important. And so how do you properly credit someone for making a contribution? And that ties into the whole idea of virtual currencies and how do you create different design currency systems that are tied into different kind of reward structures. And again, this is we're in early stages, but you start to see this kind of thing happening in the gaming environment where you have virtual currencies. Authentication is a very, very important issue. In other words, people make claims about themselves with their age or whatever. How do I know those claims are true? How can they be independently verified? So that is a kind of service that you're going to have in any kind of self-governing network. Balloting and voting, clearly a different ways in which people can participate. Oliver will describe some of that in the Digital Vermont project. Hold metadata analysis. The fact that you're doing things digitally means you can see everything that's going on. You have real transparency. You can collect data, and it's protected in the right way. Then you can make analysis and create certain new kinds of accountability based upon what you're seeing people are doing. And then enforcement. Okay, how do you enforce different kind of regimes? I mean, is it light touch, heavy touch? What is appropriate under different kind of contexts? So you're really inventing different kinds of organizational forms. And the platform is designed to support that. One of the first things we've done, and this is over another years, is develop what they call iCards, which is a project that came out of Project Higgins, and now it's on the iPhone. And it's basically an identity system that allows you to basically verify an identity and not have passwords. So you eliminate the need for passwords, and then you can automatically sign in, and it'll fill out a form based upon the profile that you want to share with that relying site. So that's sort of the first stage of developing identity system. This project, this whole effort now is part of something called Open Trust Movement that's being adopted by the government, the federal GSA, National Institute of Health. White House is doing a pilot on this. It's being supported by PayPal, IBM, Microsoft. So it's getting major support across different companies. And then the other thing that I've been interested in is when Urs is saying really being inventive, I mean, sort of, well, why not, if you really rethink the law from what is computationally possible, one of my interests has been in genetic algorithms and self-organizing systems. Why shouldn't you be able to have sort of contracts and have laws that are evolved, they're algorithmic, and so that so that you can actually write an agreement and understand how that agreement will stand up under different kind of conditions, and that gives you sort of transparency into the future. So we teamed up with a group, there's a called ConceptNet at MIT. It's sort of like a wiki for putting concepts in, and create our own version for legal concepts. And then took something like a term sheet. That was a term sheet generator that was created by Wilson Sonsini, which is a leading, it was sort of the startup venture law firm in Silicon Valley. And you say, well, can we render can we model a term sheet into a representation language that's sort of with these Lisp computing language, and then can we evolve that in such a way that it's stable under different conditions and see what the effect would be on what are called cap tables. In other words, you have different classes of shareholders and what happens under different scenarios to their holdings. So you vary a clause, you vary another clause, so what is the outcome? And actually, this is the early experiment where like phase one of the experiment actually worked much better than I thought. Now we're going to be scaling it up. And I'm glad to talk to people who are interested in that. Another thing that we've been involved in is sort of the whole idea of government and governance as a platform as it applies to what the initiatives coming out of new administration. So we did pioneer we partnered with the O'Reilly Group in this Summit 2.0 conference that came up in Washington, and that was a sort of gathering of people to rethink government as a whole set as a platform to enable people rather than be a dispenser of services. If it's an enabler of services and let citizens come in and do things, it's sort of outsourcing in some sense or crowdsourcing a lot of government functions, particularly if you make the data very, very, very open. So there's an initiative, actually the SEC has now required all companies to put their filings in XBRL, which is a markup language, business reporting language. Once it's in that form, then lots of people can look at financial statements. And so there's a group called Free Risk that we're collaborating with, who's developing rating system, crowdsourcing rating systems. There's a company called Palantir that does data visualization that you can take this data and you can look at mortgage-backed securities in ways to see the counterparty exposures that you normally wouldn't see. So there are new services that give new opportunities for what have traditionally been regulatory functions within the province of the government itself. Can you open that out and leverage what's outside the government? There's an initiative to start something called the National Institute of Finance that we helped convene for, and that is to create a new agency that uses a lot of such tools in order to identify systemic risk and create new kinds of financial transparency. Given that if you look at all the data is created by different companies, they're all interested in their own view. Then no one has a sort of meta view of what the systemic risk is. So you really have to have an agency that's chartered with that and collects that data. And that doesn't exist to date. And as I mentioned before, we've been very much involved in this open trust framework and in creating these new kind of platforms. Just to get sort of what's next, as I mentioned, one of the things that the Yokai is involved with is the an open platform for doing observation and experiment in their areas of cooperation. There's a tool we develop called ScriptGen that allows you to generate different kinds of experimental design, different kind of experiments, and run them with subjects taken from the net. We are partnering with MIT and the Media Lab particularly to work with them to developing this platform and develop pilot cases, pilot use cases, primarily how do you design entrepreneurial networks around different sets of principles. Also, they're interested in developing countries around mobile platforms, so you have what they call e-registry, ways in which people can register assets and then engage in trade in which they otherwise could not do. So it's an attestation system. And then there are lots of kinds of things that we're open to. We're really engaged in how do you do experiments in a whole wide range of areas, group formation, and the ideas have trust, and rating system, reputation system. Once you have the platform built, then you can assemble these things and run a number of different experiments. And then Oliver's going to talk about what we're doing in Vermont, and I won't dwell on that. And then, again, we'll be partnering with some, like the Aspen Institute, to do a series of roundtables in Washington on sort of the government as a platform. So I'll switch over to Oliver on that one. Oh, and the Santa Fe Institute, I forgot, on evolvable contracts. That's an area for them. Okay. Questions?
Do you want to take just a minute for a question or two while I switch shift over?
Can you rewind to the diagram you had?
Which what? Which diagram?
It's the first. Well, it's the one that the most complex one.
Well, there are a lot. No, wait. Which one do you like? Evolvable contracts.
It had the layer in the middle and a bunch of stuff below it.
The governance platform.
Yeah, I just downloaded that.
So. I got which? Oh, the iPhone.
Yeah, that one. Yeah.
Yes, yes.
So
what?
Is device a verb or a noun?
Device. It's device. Okay. Yeah, I should get it wrong. Yeah, got it right. 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 Got you. You got me now.
Okay.
You jerk. Right, I got that.
I just wanted to see that again.
The idea there
the
is
idea the platform is
is you have, so we're already actually working with folks at MIT, for example, who have a credit assignment system. So I mean, so it's like, how do you? They're doing something in knowledge markets. So how do you know who makes what kind of contribution? And then there's something called a Shapley algorithm, which is considered by being an optimal algorithm how to assign credit for contribution. So that would be, so if you're trying to build an entity in which you're going to say, okay, well, who does what? How do you reward them? How do you vote on something? And then if you have an identity system, then how do people get credit? Sort of what role-based access people have. Yeah. So you have a whole range of identity system. So what Oliver will talk about is something that's sort of the first instances, a simplified instance of this.
I want to get a sense of how that platform pulls all these things together. So they see each other even and know what they're
right. Well,
the right tentacle knows what the next right tentacle knows what it's doing.
Yeah. No, I'll show you. We have an awful because that's.
Just a quick factual question: how many thousands of people do you have working on staff? To do
hundreds
this?
Of thousands. Hundreds. It's all Mechanical Turk. It's all we totally Mechanical Turk.
Yeah,
Caroline. That's right. It's an exponential. Right. We've done things with contractors primarily, and then leveraging the internal Berkman sources. So there isn't a heavy a staff load at this point. Outsource.
Which is a polite way to say that. Are you a little overextended? The answer is yes.
No, it's a polite way of saying, are you crazy?
Yeah, that's right.
How
right.
much are you?
We had one more question here.
Do you find that virtual world, like Second Life, laws in? I recall they had some problems with their banking system.
Well, part of the inspiration, I mean, we started thinking about this actually through Second Life. I mean, and then that was sort of the early conversations with, again, Corey Andreco, who was the CTO then, and actually talking about part of the early conversations was that he said, gee, it'd be great to be able to set up and run a company in Second Life. There was another part involved with David Johnson. And that was sort of, okay, yeah, maybe that's a great idea, but it doesn't have to be in Second Life. That Second Life is certainly an opportunity to do something like that, but you don't have to go in 3D worlds.
Okay, well, if I may take over the sort of tag team here, I'm Oliver Goodenough. The Law Lab has three principal tracks, of which there's a pure research track or a pure-ish research track, and that is particularly in Yokai's And I'm doing the more application track. A lab works from ideas to application. And John courageously straddles both of these and has activities on both levels. But let me talk to you then a bit about my particular sphere, which is this application track. And I'm going to focus in on the Vermont Digital Companies, but I'm going to mention briefly some of the other work in progress there. The application track, again, the purpose of the Law Lab is to develop and disseminate, in my case, applications rooted in digital technology that help the law to meet the needs of innovators and entrepreneurs. This is the core task that we took on with that from the Kauffman Foundation, our principal funder so far, and it has informed a lot of what we do. There are several targets of these applications. There's the digital institution track, which I'm going to spend most of my time talking about. But I also want to mention that we're working with applications into the developing world. We're taking a look at some of the contracting issues, finance, the kind of work that John was talking about how can you use some of these tools to help us solve problems of venture finance. We're talking to folks into the conversation on structured finance, the securitization, the kinds of problems that came up with the mortgage securitization, and we're also looking into how to bring some of this into legal education, both in the academy and out into the further world. So that said, let me focus in a bit on digital institutions. This is the question of what happens when you put institutions, and by that we mean broadly a broad definition of institutions. A club is an institution. A government is an institution. A business organization is an institution. These are relatively formalized ways of people interacting within a structure towards some kind of common goal and purpose. What happens when we migrate those into digital world? We have this project going, particularly with Vermont. We're going to use software to create platforms for private legal structuring. And the key to us is to allow that software to be both embodying the agreement and providing for its execution, so that you get a set of potentials there that you don't get in the written world. There are four stages in this. There's the underlying legal recognition. One piece of this is that if you want the institutions can just be informal. They can live in a world that doesn't interact with the law at all. But that gets messy quickly, and so that almost all institutions bump into law at some point or another. And what we needed, first of all, was underlying legal recognition for what that would be. And I'll get to that in a moment. Where I've been lucky in the fact that Vermont has been able to take steps in that direction. Software development. I'm also lucky here to have Jeff Licht from POD, who's been working with us, and he can help backstop technical questions as we go forward. Partners and adopters, and then the deployment. Those are the stages. We're about halfway through this process as we speak now. What's the first bit? Vermont law changes. The law of business organizations in Vermont was changed in 2008 to target both corporations and LLCs. Three core steps. One is a digital interface with the state. That's nothing new in that sense. There are other states that do that, but allow you to do the digital interface for filing. Secondly, we authorize the full use of any sequentially structured digital communication as being allowed as part of the formal governance of a business organization. Again, this is pretty broad. I think that's the broadest definition out there, but it's not fully new. Other states are allowing some of this. What we added, which no one else I think has done yet, is the digital originals of bylaws, operating agreements, etc. So that we have authorized that the software isn't just a way of using what you had on writing, but it is the original of bylaws. A software program can be the original of how you do this. So you can instantiate it there. We also fixed some of the tax law questions in 2009 that allow it to go forward with a minimum impact from Vermont taxation if you are not a Vermont company. We're not Vermont based anyway.
What's the deal with sequentially structured?
Sequentially structured, it was our way of describing the fact that people could have a dialogue. That people could go back and forth. In other words, that there was a sequence, and it was structured in such a way that people would we tried to, you know, a chat room does fine, you know, all kinds of things do fine. What wouldn't do fine would be something where I could say something and nobody else could reply. So this was our attempt to define that kind of process.
Is it essential that you be able to establish the time order of when things were said so that you can establish priority? Is that that part of the thinking?
Part of the thinking is that that would take place as a natural piece of how that communication took place. That there would be, you know, that people would know, oh, I'm replying to so-and-so, you know, that over time there would be a structure and you could know who was saying what and in what order so that people could keep track of that.
Well, I was thinking, especially in terms of at some point you're going to get to enforceability.
Yes.
You would need it for that.
You would need it for that, but you also need it for good deliberation, which was what we're aiming at. What does this permit? It expands the opportunities for increasing the birth of firms, you lower cost, you do commoditization. Digitally interacting groups like Facebook companies and the virtual garage. If you suppose that you have, there's this classic myth of the folks coming together in the garage to make something. Well, suppose your garage is a workspace. A digital workspace, and you've never met each other. This would allow a company to be formed into that kind of a context. New institutions are possible, new forms of economic cooperation. Wiki companies, if Wikipedia were a corporation or a business, it could use a form like this. Low capital companies. We're looking now at the fact that capital used to be so important because you needed to hire people. Now if you can agglomerate their contributions as sort of massive sweat equity, we're looking at a free enterprise which is not capital dependent, or at least very low capital dependent. Another possibility. And a possible Cambrian explosion, things we don't know about once this gets going can happen. What makes it different? Well, there are existing set up a company online sites. We also add a forum that it's not just that you can, you know, go online to shop for a company. You use online to run your company. If you go to one of the major companies that advertises online incorporation, this is what they say you're going to get. So this is the 19th century view of what corporate governance looks like. We're coming to our 20th century view. There are challenges along the 21st, rather.
Yeah,
catch up.
Time flies, right?
There are challenges. How much standardization? In our early stages, we're going for a lot of standardization, but we want flexibility later. As kind of soft paternalism in our approach, saying that at least in the early stages, we're going to make some choices for you. Partly just because programming a lot of choices in becomes a very hard exercise, and we're solving a simpler exercise in our first thing. How much background information and counseling, how much provoking discussion among members, these are the kinds of issues that we face as we go forward. In decision making, we chose flat unanimity for this entry thing. That is a way to protect against getting voted out, outvoted and that kind of thing. It's not the best choice, it is a choice that solves particular problems and we're doing it in this version. Disputes and dispute resolution. A simple procedure. You identify something as a dispute, it's important enough, I'm willing to bet the farm on it. We have a set time for resolution, and if it's unresolved, you're either off the island if you're the sole person in the way of resolving it, i.e. you're bought out, or the company dissolves. Again, it's not the most tailored approach, but it is one that we feel we can simplify. Yes, Urs is looking there saying, yeah, I could tailor that a bit better if I gave you a little time, but we will work towards that. Liquidity, sale and withdrawal. Basically, we tried to give some choices here. They were hard to implement, so we're down to basically settle on a single choice very close to the statutory approaches. Just a quick look at what the screens look like. Again, thanks to Pod, they've been very good at doing this. A disclaimer, John always gets nervous when he sees that I styled him as my law partner. He has no law
degree. I have no standing at all, so I'd be...
He's always a little nervous on that. I wouldn't be nervous about it, John.
David advised me.
This is just to demo, and is not a claim that John actually is an attorney at law. But again, we have screens where you enter, where you're taken through a process, a very, very typical... Kind of animated process for collecting information and things. We set new members. We begin the operating agreement, allocating who gets what kind of shares of things. Once that's set, then there's you can review the documents. You see a whole set of things, and then on the right hand side of this, you see the voting procedure. A vote is in process, and we put things out there. We have this procedure for voting, and as I said, in this iteration, nothing is adopted unless everybody agrees. We felt that if you were dealing with strangers and that kind of thing, or semi-strangers, this was probably the best kind of choice for giving comfort, if not the best choice for flexibility. Yeah.
That means that somebody who has a 1% share has the same vote as somebody who has a 75% share?
And the answer is yes on this, which is actually the default rule in LLCs and partnership laws generally. That is actually mimics the default rule. By way of disclaimer, this is probably best for a company of five rather than for a company of 400.
Like
Okay. This is aimed at a small working group that will be intimately involved in.
Probably doesn't have shares as unequal as what I just described.
You could not. You could, but you probably would then want not to use this form under that circumstance, or to be comfortable with the fact that everybody's going to have an equal vote.
Right.
Next steps. What are our next steps? We're looking for partners and adopters, different constituencies and business models. We're talking to lawyers and law firms, banks and other service providers. There's an opportunity in here for a hosting business. Anybody who wants to talk about a hosting business, we're happy to talk with you. But also, some of our targets are LinkedIn, Facebook, that kind of thing. The notion being that a provider like a law firm could simply put an application into Facebook and say, by the way, if you want to have your Facebook company, click here. You want to have, or LinkedIn, you know, again, a more business-related social networking platform. Click here, and you can have your business here. Implementing deployment, where the software development process continues. We're I'm not sure whether we'd say we're in Alpha 2 at this point. Anyway, we have a demo up that runs, but it's not a fully complete. We're just finishing the fully complete demo. Rollout release this fall. It is, by the way, all open source. Anyone who would like to have the code may, and if anybody who would like to have the code and elaborate it, may.
Please do.
You know, normal sort of Creative Commons style license. For the future, Cambrian explosion may come. We're not there yet, but we're open to it. And also nonprofits. We're going to get hopefully the Vermont law on nonprofits amended to be the same way as this, and we're working with the OneClick folks in the UK on how nonprofits would work. Take the model to current businesses beyond Vermont. We're looking internationally. You know, what does this look like as part of this notion of cloud law of this available as a structuring tool that would not just be for the U.S. but international. And then John's evolvable law. We can accelerate the Cambrian. Anyway, that's a very quick run through, but hopefully enough to give you a flavor. Again, many thanks for on us all. The Ewing Marion Kaufman Foundation, which has provided the generous grant that makes this all possible. Berkman Center, obviously. Goodrich Institute and my colleagues here and at POD. And one of the reasons why we're in Vermont is I mentioned that my Vermont state representative is also my spouse. And this has made working with the Vermont legislature particularly possible for some of these initiatives.
These things matter, yes.
Any questions?
Open questions.
Yeah.
I'm kind of wondering, so this sounds great, and you're putting it out there, and you're talking about clicking on Facebook, but you can have massive spoofing attacks, somebody collecting all this data for nefarious purposes. You talked a little bit at some point about reputation and how you determine identity and things like that. Are you factoring those things together so that people...
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the... I mean, it is one of the things that we've been very much concerned about is having a secure identity system. And so, and that's where the whole authentication aspect comes in. So the iCards is a first effort to do that. And and I might add that is something that's just not we're doing. That's a much broader initiative. So it ties into there's a meta system of interoperability among existing identity systems. So something that's Microsoft, IBM, Google supports it. So we can leverage, we can make it possible depending upon how rigorous people want to be about this. I mean, there's this confluence of iCards and OpenID in what's called a new trust framework. So you have different levels of assurance. You go from, so first level assurance to a third level, fourth level. And depending on the importance or the nature or the cost and consequences of a breach, you actually will select a security mechanism that's appropriate to that. It's hard to get people to adopt to a more rigorous one, you know, if you're going to go into sort of a third level assurance. But that's one of the things that we've done is with worked with getting the iCard, which provides a relatively secure way of logging in and protecting identity and security and the spoofing. I mean, it was designed, the whole design of that was, it started out Microsoft and IBM, was it prevents spoofing attacks and things like that, phishing and, yep.
I was wondering how smoothly the software catches up with the decisions of the partners. For example, if the partners vote unanimously to switch to a majority rule system, that decision wouldn't take effect until a programmer changed the code. Is that right?
That is correct. One of the things we do in this is if, or the other alternative which is built into it is that if you can opt out of the program.
Oh, I see.
so that if you wanted to change rules that were not to rules that are not supportable by the program, one of the available options is to say, okay, guess what, folks? Now we're opting out of the program as our operating system, and we'll go back to mail and email and sitting down with each other and using stamps and all that good stuff.
To one of the points is if you take the LLC structure and the shell and you say, how would you componentize that? And if you want to scale, and this is the platform concept, so you may have different kind of voting mechanisms you want to subscribe to. You may want to have a different kind of dispute resolution. So the idea is create an architecture where you can select each of those and then create an agreement that represents that. Then people will be innovating. You make it a modular, so someone's over here and says, I'm going to be innovating in dispute resolution. I get 20 different ways of doing that. And so then you can subscribe to that as a software service, so then you mash it up, and then you have a new kind of operating agreement.
And that's basically John's chart with the many elements. Is that
with Doc like so much?
In talking, we originally thought about making the full jump to that right away, and decided that was a too big a leap for a number of reasons, mm-hmm. and so we have consciously as a first step used this much more hardwired and limited approach in this software. But yes, the eventual goal would be to both. Just fully enough describe what are the necessary elements of a governance system, figure out the interconnectability of those elements, disputes, permissions, votes, identity, sharing of proceeds, that kind of thing, and then open, have an open spine, as it were, onto which a variety of different solutions to that could be elected, and those solutions could either be little modules, or they could be programmable in and of themselves to have variety.
One of the things we're trying to do is and have say like fellowship programs, like 2 or 3 year fellowship programs, where someone would be cross disciplinary. So someone, say we're doing this jointly with MIT, so you want a team who has cross disciplinary skills that would say focus on a reputation system or focus on designing a dispute resolution system, because I think part of the challenge here is that these things take time to build. You can't do that, and people should get credit for it. It should be part of building a reputation in their own career, and so it is definitely multidisciplinary.
Jeff, would you comment on any of this as our programmer as this goes forward? Is there a piece of?
I mean, I think there's a range of options that are in the system right now, and so we've been expanding it to allow people to join, to leave, and handle transfer of assets and so forth. And we can define a dozen of those parameters and parameters them internally and track them dynamically. But I think there's a sort of building a kind of simple, easy to use experience that people can just go and get started with is one problem. Building something which can adapt to all these different modules and all different ways of doing it is another problem. Making that complicated web of connections easy to use is a third problem. So we started with that first piece, and it can be expanded. The model's there in terms of how you want to add more things, but it's not kind of a flip a switch scenario.
Sure.
So this is all very informative and helpful, in particularly giving a sense of the range of things you're doing. So as I was listening to it, I'm trying to identify in this large set what the goals are. As best I can tell, I'm hearing from you 4 different things. Maybe they're all compatible, but I'd be interested in their response. So some of the time you seem to be saying goal of this project is efficiency. You just want to provide mechanisms to allow people to do more efficiently things that they have been doing traditionally. It's cheaper and faster and more flexible, less creaky, less transaction costs in employing the mechanisms that we supply than to be employing old structures. Right, that's one. And some of the time I hear also a kind of egalitarian impulse, that we want to make some of these activities more accessible to people without any resources. So, for example, reference to the non-capital-based startups. It's implicitly invoking a model in which people without access to capital,
right,
who resources. And your evocation briefly of you're down to benefit developing countries, sounds a little bit of that note. Okay, so there's a different kind of impulse from efficiency. It's broadening access to people for poor. That's number two. Number three would seem to be more substantive, sort of more of a vision here. So when the recurring themes of identity and trust and authentication, and that's not just efficiency and egalitarianism. Something is different happening here. It's the idea of stabilizing the person or the entity in the virtual space in a way that is controversial as a conception of what digital media and activity should be about. It cuts sharply against a sort of postmodern multiple avatars, multiple identities, flux vision. Wait a minute. There's one more, which is, if I get it right, there's a libertarian streak here too. There's a general distrust of centralized decision-making, particularly centralized governmental decision-making, a lack of faith in legislation or adjudication in their traditional forms, and a sense that private parties working outside the ambit of the traditional government process can better devise systems of rules and can better devise mechanisms for enforcing. Again, if that's right, it's also quite controversial as a way in which you would implement your vision. So am I right in guessing at these? And you see them all as
wait, I'm talking the truth. I think if we roll back to part of the interdisciplinary nature, and sort of saying, when you talk about trust, identity, and sort of understanding how people cooperate and how they form the bands of trust, there's a whole lot of work that's being done in signaling theory and being in the neuroscience of how groups are formed and how identities formed and how do you create how groups manage risk. And so I think there's a body of literature, whether it's really not so much political one way or libertarian or not, it's just saying, How do these things work? I mean, it's sort of, and how does evolution work to manage risk over time? And how do social signals and how do reputations get built? And how to, and there's a whole body of thinking around that, and how do you get pro-social behavior and not pro-social behavior, so to innate or not? So I think part of this is to leverage that research. And bring that into the design of these different kinds of governance mechanisms. I think it's that to say it's. I mean, I can certainly say when we with the, you stress the, sort of the private production of law and the fact that people can you can start to look like analyze and say, well, how do you go from norms to rule sets to how these things emerge and how do you get sort of more formal codifications? I think that's still part of an empirical question of research. It's not. We're not. I don't have an ideological view on that. I do because I think
they're going to make some things easier than others. You're not just watching; you're intervening in these processes.
Well, I think you're creating tools that people can create. I mean, I think you're really saying, well, here's the thought. I mean, is that you? Part of it comes from synthetic biology, which they're saying, okay, how do you break down biology into independent components with standard interfaces, and then that you can assemble different kind of living organisms. I mean, so the idea is, can you then identify what those key components are, whether it be an identity system, what attributes it has, or reputation systems, how that affects a self-governing network, dispute resolution, not saying what they are, but are these required components to get some kind of governance mechanism?
I'm going to take issue with the way you posed your question, because you posed the question as though there was a necessary dichotomy between the impulse for regulation, which I agree with as being appropriate in many cases, and the impulse for private initiative in terms of structuring, which I think is appropriate in many cases. I don't see that there's a necessary opposition between the two. Yes, they are two pieces of our toolkit. You know, I got a saw I use sometimes, I got a hammer I use sometimes. I don't view myself being in opposition to government and regulation simply because I'm also paying attention to the places where the other is appropriate and trying to make that better. I, I'm 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 Again, the fact that we're focused in on one of these does not mean that I'm opposed to the other in any way. I'm not. I think that there's very good reasons for the use of that tool when that's the appropriate one. So again, I agree that we've made some emphasis. This is my project comes out of the tradition of private business law and private nonprofit law, which allows for private ordering. That's what we accept and we allow. That doesn't mean I'm again the other. So again, I think that you were setting up a dichotomy that doesn't necessarily exist. Yes, we've got one focus, but it's not necessarily at the expense of the other.
Yeah, let me. Okay, go ahead.
Come back. The second point that you said was somewhat controversial. The third of your four points was.
Perception of the digital environment based around identities.
And again, I think that there's perhaps a false dichotomy there. Right. The web is very good at exactly the stuff you're talking about. Avatars, openness, all of this kind of thing, reinventing yourself, the whole notion of the internet as the new Wild West, you know, where you can move in and be new and all that. And that is wonderful, too. But again, there are contexts within which that isn't how you need to present yourself to accomplish certain kinds of goals. And so the identity layers that we're building in here are require. I mean, again, if you're entering into a long-term economic arrangement with somebody, you want to have some notion of who they are. Probably. So there are places where that openness is completely appropriate and should be celebrated. There are also going to be contexts where, as we develop relationships between each other, we need more or something different. And again, I think that they're different flavors, but again, I don't think that they're mutually exclusive as to the times and places where each is appropriate. So again, I think we're focused in on one subset of the times and places of the web, and not of others.
The whole idea of a multi, you have a plurality of identities. I mean, if the identity system does not prescribe an Uber identity for everyone, I mean, you can have a whole range appropriate to context. So you can be authenticated and be anonymous. You can be anonymous. You can be, but it's part of the experiment is to understand what works and what's out of context. But clearly, if you're going to do some kind of things, you need to have a persistent identifier that can be linked back to you, and because then you don't have any enforcement mechanism. But that represents one case. So I don't think we're prejudicial to saying there's one solution that fits all. So you want to, and that's part of a design problem. Is how do you have the plurality that enables that?
And if I may go back then to questions one and two, which is. I think that both of those were essentially things we're exploring, partly because those are things that are properties of the web. The web opens up both better ways of doing what we already do, great, and things we didn't know we could do before, things we couldn't imagine to have done before. I mean, this is one of the astonishing things. And so our initiative as we go forward, as I say, is a bit of both of those. That we're looking to do things that we've done very traditionally a bit better. Great, but we're also looking to open into the sphere of the yet unknown. What is the wiki company going to look like? If that's what is the low capital, the post capitalist company going to look like? I mean, these are things that are part of the potential.
Just to add to just the whole the governance 2.0 platform. The fact this administration there's a huge emphasis on having open data and open government. And by doing that, you're able to achieve a lot more transparency and accountability than otherwise. And the technology plays a big role in that. But how that done, then the issue of trust between citizen and the government becomes very important. It says, well, now, the citizen makes it a claim that I am X, but does the government know that? And also the government says, I'll protect your data or I won't misuse it. Well, how do we know that? I mean, these are sort of foundational. And then how you build the technology platforms enable that, really they percolate all the way up, in my belief. So. It, to me, it's sort of a fundamental issue. Yeah.
You say that contracts and maybe laws and regulations are defined by running computer code. What does it mean to say that the code has a bug or isn't working as expected if it's the defining entity?
It gives a certain responsibility to making sure that your code's pretty good.
Except that code is never 100%.
Neither is a partnership agreement written by even a relatively good law firm. Say that will be bug free as well. But one hopes to do one's best to demo.
I think one of the ideas that if you can export a sort of static digitally signed version of the agreement that everyone's agreed to, you can. Might be a fallback mechanism, for example. But
And that actually is a requirement of the Vermont laws, that although it can have a digital original, the digital original must be susceptible to being reduced to some kind of written statement.
Something that's static and unchangeable.
Yeah.
Just to fine-tune what was said, what I heard earlier was algorithm, which is different from programming. And an algorithm can have a flaw. An algorithm which is implemented by a program with a bug in it is a flawed implementation of the algorithm.
But then how is it, what formality do you have for the algorithm?
Algorithm is written. It is written in human. Prose, you're saying.
Right. But your point is correct. That we've reversed the process and made the program the original, but be readable. I've looked at existing bylaws or which have you know circles of unresolvable prose in them.
So, when you say that something is defined by an algorithm, well, unless you have a formal algorithmic language, that's not that much of a programming language. So,
it's a good point. It's a good point.
So, what happens to the, or what's your vision for what will substitute for the current process where attorneys explain to their clients what the implications are and the redlining goes back and forth? Is it now programmers and attorneys passing things back and forth?
The format we're using in the current project, and this is again where we're doing it, is that it's been premised on the fact that it would probably have some attorneys as its sponsors. And that there are click boxes, explanations and that kind of thing, and three or four different places where you say, by the way, if you need further advice, come talk to a live person by clicking here. Again, one of the interesting questions as we get into a more developed form and where there are options is what will be the role of a lawyer in counseling even into that space, and it may be that the lawyers. Maybe that the eventual more complicated tools are lawyer tools rather than pro se style tools, but the pro se is available already through legal Zoom and other places. We're certainly I think going to be better than that. I hope.
Wilson Sonsini, the term sheet generator they have now is you can actually generate a term sheet, but it'll have flags and windows explain, say what a participating preferred is, and then it'll actually give market data and say what is most prevalent use of this in the market, which is actually generally don't get that from a law firm. And so someone can go through that. And I've done 8 startups, and I can tell you that a lot of the stuff that you get from attorneys is in a second reading, they will not know what they've written on a shareholder agreement or something like that. It gets very, very complex. So if there's a set of, part of the thing, if there's a set of conventions that are norms agreed within a group that are seen as being fair and are as self-evident as possible, that may be a better way to proceed for certain types of transactions.
Yeah, part of this discussion reminds me of the Creative Commons license discussion, whether this replaces copyright or not. Actually, it's built upon copyright law. And so I really think it's not about replacing the law or lawyers. I'm myself a lawyer. I'm not trying to replace myself in that sense. So, but really to figure out what are kind of helpful tools to enable transactions, enable innovative businesses or entrepreneurship.
Good point. Yes, Creative Commons is a privately generated new form of ordering within the general sphere. So it again would be a kind of an example of the sort of thing that we're looking to try and develop.
So how does the experience of legal inform what you're doing? Because that's been out there for several years doing the same kind of thing.
Actually, my point was they're not doing the same thing. Legal Zoom, the end product of Legal Zoom is they have only automated the first step, which is essentially ordering a company. You can order the company online. Once the company exists, then you're thrown back into the old pen and paper world of company formalities and management. What we're saying is that no, we will allow you to effectively automate and use digital means to implement the entire life history of at a formal level of a company, and that you can go from soup to nuts without having to have touched a piece of paper in the whole thing.
But part
that's
of
not where LegalZoom takes you yet.
But the operating agreement doesn't necessarily you don't necessarily have to have a board of directors. You don't necessarily have you can invent a new governance. You can have peer to peer governance. You can invent new methods of governance within the context of the LLC. So you could have millions of members, which you can't, and you could have them have a participating role, which is something you could do digitally. You could do effectively, pen and paper.
Again, I've got that picture from the LegalZoom folks.
David.
So I'm going to ask a friendly question, but then I want to put a little point on it. So the friendly question is, so talk about how this is an open process, because both of you have mentioned that one of the aims of the Law Lab is to open all this stuff up. So that's the friendly question, which I'm interested in. And the point on it is just to express a concern that I've expressed to you before, John. I stand in awe of what you do. The thing that worries me and why I'm particularly interested in seeing this being opened up, not just because of the new ideas that will emerge and all the rest of that, but if we forgot that you're actually, you know, pretty small group at a small center in a small city on the East Coast, and look at the list of things that you're doing, it's a gigantic, world-changing list of things, right? If you were able to do all those things, the world would be substantially different, including, for example, around identity, where the system may be fantastic. It's, as I'm sure you would agree, it's likely to have unintended consequences. It's an emergent environment. Who knows? If iCards become the norm, then we don't know what it will do to, for example, the ecology of open identity. Maybe nothing. Maybe support it. Maybe make it better. Maybe create some market forces that start to impinge upon that. We don't know. So given the scope and ambition of what you're doing, as the fundamental nature of your project, I'm particularly interested in making sure that the projects as they go forward are wide open, not just for suggestions, but for the public debate that
absolutely.
So, how are you doing that?
Well, I mean,
so back to the friendly question. How are you opening this up?
Well, I think what we need to get started. I mean, if we need to get to the points, I think we're tangible results so that you can get things out. I think that we had workshops in Washington where we brought lots of people together around these sets of issues. I think that what's going to, I think as this matures, and maybe, and I think you're thinking more around the identity issues, but there have been lots of discussions. There's been a lot of discussion around that. One has different views on this. One thing I can say is that the way it was going before this sort of identity metasystem concept came about and was adopted, you were going to have basically a top-down Orwellian approach to that. That's where the government was going. And I think that would have been very draconian, would have not been secured, it would have done the civil liberties. But the argument that I would like to encourage is that when you start designing these mechanisms, you start designing new kinds of institutions. And so it's like, so the consequences are very important. And I think little decisions, as you say, can have major implications. And I think all the more scrutiny you have around it, I totally agree with. I think you're in a climate right now where the cybersecurity issues that are presidential are so high, they're so feverish, that there's an attempt to get a cyber czar, but that there were 30 job offered to 30 people have been turned down. It's not realistic to think there'd be a cyber czar. So what's going to happen is going to have it on the outside. So the government is not going to be an identity provider. They're going to outsource that and set standards for it. So that creates a sort of a privatization of a primary function. All these things are sort of happening. And there are a lot of technical issues. They're very complex that it's hard to get a group around to engage upon. So I'm, you know, all for that.
So there is also kind of something that clarified probably. The platform that John was talking about is slightly different in terms of what actually the Law Lab is contributing to versus the platform that Oliver was describing for the digital LLC, right? Where actually we are doing coding and, you know, messing around with code, basically. I think the platform that John was describing is much more at the conceptual level to understand how an open platform would look like that would enable things like emergence of new governance structures, be it in a public sector context, be it in a private sector context. So this is much more about creating interoperability based on a deep understanding what are key ingredients that you need to have in place. Whether you want to run a company, whether you want to have an open, transparent government process in place, or whether you want to create, like Jochen is working on, an observational platform to see how collaboration emerges on platforms such as Wikipedia and others. What are kind of basic tools that you need to have? And it's not about we are making decisions about how the identity tool or the privacy, reputation tool is built, but actually to
That's
be
right.
open to have different plugins and provide the abilities to mix and mash up different existing tools. And therefore, as I mentioned in the introduction, much of the LoLab is network building, understanding what are people developing at other centers in companies, and think about an interoperable platform that allows you kind of to combine different things.
Right.
So this is slightly different platform building rather, as opposed to what Oliver described, which actually the coding is happening here house and the collaboration of the pod. So this may be helpful as a distinction. So we have less sensitivity in making design choices of this sort. There are two questions.
It seems that generally you are referring to law as something. Okay, we have law out there, now we're going to think about how to use new tools. And I'm wondering whether you may be missing out on the ability of these new tools to actually rethink about the concept of law. And I think the most obvious example would be how we're rethinking about property now, and we have those commons and common space, which actually changed what law used to think about property. And it has some of this kind of notion throughout your thing, but very deliberate. And I think Thierry was right in that many times you actually stick to what law now thinks and try to strengthen that. And I wonder whether or not you should use it in order to push back on concepts of law that you're now using.
Well, to my own view, I mean, I didn't communicate it correctly. I mean, I'm very interested in sort of going fundamentally rethinking what constitutes law, so that you roll it all the way back to how the rules are formed and people interacting. So I was mentioned that the fundamental science of social signaling and biology, and I love that, was a whole body of knowledge around it, is to say, well, how do people interact over time, and where they go from informal to more formalized conventions, and how does that get codified? And what are the different kind of mechanisms involved? This is something that Jochen is very much interested in. And they say, because there are, in the neuroscience, there are certain mechanisms in the brain for socialization processes that we are wired to as a species. So it's sort of like uncovering that and getting the appropriate level of abstraction, if you think of it from a computer science point of view, that allows you then to see how these different things combine, rather than start at the wrong level.
And again, it's
not political.
Although I didn't present it in any detail here, one of the goals of the digital institutions is to make possible whole new ways of organizing people together,
right,
that are not the classic, you know, stock, capital, all of those things. You know, I apologize that my initial example is a more limited one. But the notion is that in this field, we're going to be able to invent ways for people to interact reliably that will let them have an institution that will look very different. That will still be a voluntary institution, but will look very different than the temporary equilibrium that the now classic corporation constitutes. It's a temporary equilibrium. Other things will come, and
right,
as that happens, I think what you're talking about will be hopefully part of what occurs.
Yes.
Yeah, coming back to the privacy issues, I guess one of the problems, or there are many problems, of course, but one challenge is that there's very different interpretation internationally on the right to privacy as a human right. And when I was listening to your talk and you talk about evolvable contracts, I was thinking that working in the field of human rights, we have these very general standards, and we know that they are subject to dynamic interpretation.
Yeah.
So they have to be applied in any given context and be interpreted in that context. But it just varies so much on a global level. But it would be really cool to have a tool where you had easily accessible information about how, for instance, the right to privacy has been enforced. in the little case law that has started to develop across the globe. So, I mean, we have case law in Europe and we have some in the US, but it's increasingly coming across the globe in as technology starts to even reach the courtroom in terms of judgment. And I was just thinking that would be a very useful tool, especially with the right to privacy and freedom of expression, that are the two rights that are mostly applied.
We should talk then.
Probably one last question or comment
I think this idea of using algorithms for contracts is a really intriguing one. The one thing that I wonder about, though, is what happens if you sit down to write a contract and you realize that the really good algorithm to describe what you want to do is already patented. All right, so you sit down, you write a suboptimal algorithm. What do you do then? I mean, somebody might want to patent that. My answer would be hire Evan Mullen.
Well, it's also unclear from a patentability standpoint where business methods are going to be going.
Yeah,
and it
yeah.
is also probable that much of the algorithms that we're talking about have already been used in word-based contracting. They just haven't been formalized into a more...
The genetic algorithm, so. But there was actually some of them are patented, actually.
Well, anyway, good point. Good point.
Thank you.
Excellent. So thank you very much. This was really interesting also to get feedback from... who have had less exposure to the lab than I had in the past few months. Just to close with a few thoughts. Why I'm excited to be part of the LawLab initiative is you get really exposure to ideas that you would usually not have if I would stick in my room with all my books that are covering a lot of legal stuff. So indeed, some of the ideas that John presented today are challenging or sometimes uncomfortable for us lawyers, and I see it as the very purpose of the Law Lab to have this discourse and actually to work together across disciplines in a network to challenge ourselves and use that as an opportunity for evolution of law itself, but also to think openly about alternatives and complements to law. So that's kind of the beauty of it. I think we've also clearly got the impression that this is a true lab, so there are many more open questions than answers. It would be strange to think of a lab as something where, you know, everything is already kind of perfectly designed and where we have all the wonderful outputs and can tell you already how it will be applied. I think it's the very nature of a lab, you know, that is messy, that there are many balls in the air, that we try things and we'll drop some balls, of course, so this is part of the process. As long as it's well documented, hopefully it contributes kind of to research and science in the long run. Of course, another point, and this is duly noted, is every lab should have a code of ethics, right? So I hear Terry very well saying, by actually taking up certain projects and working on certain tools, that's already making a statement, and this is of course not a value neutral statement. I think the way we approached it so far, and I'm of course eager to get more feedback from you also offline, is, well, of course we make choices, but what we try to do at the same time is to have diversity within the lab. So we have different viewpoints, we have people with different backgrounds, and you know, we have different views on laws and on values to a certain extent. So it's also kind of a really open a place where different viewpoints can meet and where we can involve also in hard discussions about different concepts. And the second thing I think is we try to be transparent. So also thanks to Caroline and our team here at the center, all what we are doing is actually public. It's posted on our website. We are, you know, inviting people. We are inviting all of you to comment on our work, to criticize, to challenge it. So I think this sort of transparency and openness combined with diversity is how we try to deal with some of the challenges that, Terry as well as David identified earlier on. So with that, thanks again, and we're looking forward to continue the conversation with all of you. Thank you.